listening to the testimony of an officer turned informant, a look at the unraveling corruption scandal in the anti-gang unit of the Los Angeles Police Department, and students around the country protest sweatshops. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. More than a dozen students held a sit-in at the University of Pennsylvania. Members of a group calling itself Penn Students Against Sweatshops were overnight there, urging the school to join a new group monitoring conditions in factories that make clothing bearing the school name and logo. The sit-in was set up by students who were supporting the Workers' Rights Consortium, set up by students and non-governmental organizations. We also got this call from the University of Michigan.
Hi, this is Lee Palmer calling. I'm a student at the University of Michigan, and we're currently occupying the second floor of the LSMA building here at U of M. It's the College of Language, Science, and Arts Dean's Office. We're members of the anti-sweatshop movement. We're calling for President Lee Bollinger to join as a member to the Worker Rights Consortium to enforce his code of conduct that he signed after our sit-in last year.
That from the University of Michigan. And we also get a report from the University of Wisconsin. There the students are continuing their sit-in. They're protesting the fact that though the chancellor agreed to be part of the Fair Labor Association, which was set up by corporations to monitor their own factories around the world, he had agreed last June, after 6 months, to a review of their practices. An advisory group was set up of students as well as administrators when it looked like they would be voting for him to pull out of the Fair Labor Association and join the Workers' Rights Consortium set up by students and NGOs. He said he didn't want an overall vote. He was disbanding the group and wanted individuals in the group to tell him what they thought. This caused the students at the University of Wisconsin, also to protest. We got this report from Jill Hopke from community station WORT in Madison.
Yesterday, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, seven students entered the chancellor's office demanding the university end its affiliation with the Fair Labor Association, the FLA, and sign on to the Workers' Rights Consortium, the WRC. After their request to meet with the chancellor were denied, they began an occupation of the office, refusing to leave until their demands were met. Shortly, over 150 students entered the administration building, calling for the doors of the chancellor's office to be opened so they could join those inside. Later, university police entered the chancellor's office through a basement door. Several students attempting to gain entrance to the chancellor's office were pepper-sprayed by police. No serious injuries or arrests resulted from this incident. The seven students inside the chancellor's office U-locked themselves together with bike locks to prevent the police from removing them from the office. Chancellor David Ward later stated, based on reports he had received, he believed the police response to be appropriate. After 5 hours, Ward arrived on campus to address students. He stated the university will withdraw from the FLA, but will not be signing on to the WRC at this time. He will not make a decision about whether or not to join the WRC and will be unavailable to meet with students until next Monday. The students spent the night in the administration building and will continue the sit-in until Ward returns to meet with them and the university signs on to the WRC. For Democracy Now!, I'm Jill Hopke in Madison, Wisconsin.
The 13-million-strong AFL-CIO Labor Federation yesterday called for a full amnesty to give permanent legal status to an estimated 6 million illegal immigrants and hold employers accountable for exploiting them. The AFL-CIO Executive Council unanimously approved the policy resolution, which calls for the repeal of the so-called I-9 sanctions, a process that imposes sanctions on employers that hire undocumented workers. It also called for guarantees that all workers receive full protection on issues of workplace rights and freedoms. and this news from East Timor. An emotional UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, was greeted with cheers and tears when he arrived in East Timor today, laying a wreath at a church where dozens of people were massacred by Indonesian military and militia before the referendum vote this summer. Annan and his wife cried as he laid the wreath in the town of Likisa, scene of some of the worst bloodshed before and after the UN-run vote, which overwhelmingly chose to call for independence. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Defense lawyers for four white New York City police officers accused of murdering Amadou Diallo rested their case yesterday, courtroom in Albany, New York, with the prosecution deciding not to cross-examine the last witness, nor to present rebuttal witnesses to the week-long defense. Both sides agreed that the jury be allowed to consider less serious charges than second-degree murder against the officers. In a surprisingly swift end to the trial's testimony, prosecutors decided not to cross-examine an expert witness on police practices, even though the expert, Dr. James Fife, a professor at the Temple University of Criminal Justice, as well as a former New York City police officer, made it clear in his testimony that he believed the four officers who killed Diallo in a hail of 41 bullets became players in a tragedy, not participants in a deadly crime. Diallo was shot to death the early morning of February 4, 1999, while he was standing in the vestibule of his Bronx apartment building. He was unarmed, holding a leather wallet, which officers claimed over and over again during the trial they thought was a gun. Final arguments are scheduled for Tuesday. If convicted of second-degree murder, the officers, Sean Carroll, Edward McMillan, Kenneth Boss, and Richard Murphy, face 25 years to life. However, the penalties for the lesser charges range from a minimum of up to 5 years in prison for first-degree manslaughter to a minimum of probation for criminally negligent homicide. We're joined right now by Leslie Brody. She is co-chair of the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild to assess the presentation of this case, both by the prosecution and defense. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Leslie.
Thank you, Amy. Good morning.
Well, it's good to be with you. Well, why don't you start off by giving us your overall impression of what has transpired over this very swift trial?
Well, my overall impression is I think that, not surprisingly to me, the prosecution, I don't think, ever wanted to go forward with murder two against these officers. And I think there are policy decisions that get made behind the scenes that are important to take a look at. For example, if you have a case that is so high profile and you have a lead prosecutor and someone who is what's called second chairing that prosecutor, you're going to make strategic decisions as to who is presiding over what portion of the trial. When you have your lead prosecutor foregoing cross-examination of the four police officers, you have to wonder what's going on in the prosecution's mind.
Repeat that last point.
The last point I was making is when you have a lead prosecutor on a case who is presumably your heavy hitter, that's the person you want to put out there to do the most important tasks in the trial.
In this case, it's Eric Warner.
Right. And that would be, and the most important task would be cross-examination of your key, of the defense key witnesses, which would be the four police officers. When you forego cross-examination by that lead prosecutor and you put the person in who's second chairing to do that cross-examination, right there I was wondering, what's the thinking? Why wouldn't you have your lead person doing the cross-examination?
Now, let's talk about also the significance of this and what it requires of a prosecutor. In the case of these four police officers, they are hearing their testimony for the first time, right? Because they didn't testify before the grand jury.
That's correct. Not only didn't they testify before the grand jury, but they didn't give any statements whatsoever about what happened that night prior to the trial. So a prosecutor has to be very savvy in terms of using excellent cross-examination techniques to control the witnesses. And what happened was you had the prosecutor up there asking open-ended questions, in a sense going on a fishing expedition, but never really controlling the witness by asking the kinds of leading questions that elicit the responses that you know you want to get.
But this is so obvious. I mean, we watched this trial. Not your point, but I mean exactly right. What they did. Everyone was saying, where's Warner in this? The head doing the key, challenging the key testimony, and that's of the officers themselves. How do they get away with this?
Well, they did, but I just want to, I think the really important point is for people to understand, I believe that one of the things that's at play here is the Bronx District Attorney's Office has to have an ongoing relationship with the police. That's who they're depending on to make their cases. So they did not, I don't believe they wanted to bring these officers down for murder too. So I think they wanted to create a public impression that to some degree they're pursuing this case seriously, but they wanted to certainly stop short of the top charges.
So why did they do murder two then?
Well, interestingly, the New York Times cites this morning that they put murder two into the grand jury. And again, there may have been a public pressure aspect of it, but the grand jury has a very low threshold. And again, the prosecution presents a bare bones case, and the grand jury in all likelihood was going to indict on murder two. It creates the public perception that the prosecution wanted at the time. And then when they go forward to trial, it was, I think, easy enough to throw those higher charges.
Do you think public pressure did make the difference last year? You were involved, actually, in representing people who were, more than 1,000 people were arrested calling
That's
for
correct.
Prosecution of the officers, including the Reverend Jesse Jackson and others.
I think it had to play into some degree. I've never, you know, in the time that I've been in New York, certainly, I've never seen a civil disobedience, acts of civil disobedience of that magnitude. And people were so passionate about this, and they came out day after day after day. And actually, I have to say that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office ultimately agreed to dismissals in the interest of justice, which is unusual when you have 1,100-plus people who have tied up the system. And I think they did that because of the enormous public pressure.
What about the 48-hour rule and how this played into this? It's something that is unique in New York. Maybe there's a city in the country that also had this for their police, but that says for 48 hours the police are not questioned, they're not tested for drugs and alcohol, and no one can talk to them outside.
Right. I mean, I obviously don't like the 48-hour rule. I think in this particular case it probably didn't have much play because the defense attorneys were going to get in there right away knowing that there were going to be criminal charges imminent and they weren't going to let them talk no matter what.
What about the challenging of these four officers who all say, I mean, they say it was dimly lit inside the vestibule, but they all say they saw Amadou Diallo holding a gun. I mean, they're not contending now that he had a gun, but at the time.
Right. I mean, I don't even know where to start with this. This is where I think the prosecution was just tossing softballs. I mean, some of the statements that Sean Carroll made, that Edward McMullen made, that went totally unchallenged by the prosecution were amazing to me. Let me see if I can come up with one. I think it was Sean Carroll who said...
Now, Sean Carroll and Edward McMullen were the first two officers on the scene. They are the ones who both shot at Amadou Diallo 16 times each.
That's correct. And I believe it was Sean Carroll who said, let me see if I can recall what his words were. When he was talking about having asked Amadou Diallo to put his hands up in the air, he said, after I asked him a couple of times to put his hand, or after we commanded that he put his hands up in the air, Sean Carroll didn't say Amadou Diallo didn't respond, which I think would have been the objective way to pose it. Amadou Diallo didn't respond. What he said was, this man just didn't want to listen. Now, I think that is so, the subtext there is so indicative of the attitude that these police officers go into these neighborhoods with. The prosecution didn't touch that. I think they should have been all over it. That's a characterization. He's not saying this man didn't respond. We don't know why, and we felt that we had to go forward when we saw that he had a gun. They said he didn't want to listen. So that was one statement. I believe it was Edward McMullen who talked about, first of all, he talked about coming out of a car, showing his shield, and giving his standard request, New York City police officer, may I have a word with you, please? Give me a break. This is the street crimes unit. Their motto, we own the night. They're aggressively trained. This has been all over the news. to me, that statement just on its face seems ridiculous, and I thought there was no fleshing out of that statement. And then later on, that very same officer, Edward McMillan, referred to these words in the form of a command. It's like he went back and forth in his testimony, at first phrasing it as a question, later on phrasing it as a command, and that was never touched, that inconsistency.
And Richard Murphy said he heard the officers say, "Put up your hands," which they didn't even contend they said.
Right.
We're talking to Leslie Brody, who is co-chair of the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Okay, now, the whole question of why couldn't the prosecutors raise the past records of these officers? Now, I know that the judge, State Supreme Court Judge Teresi, had said you can't raise it, unless, of course, the defense opens the door. So you have the defense on direct saying to each of their officers, you know, talk about your awards. For example, Kenneth Boss, he said he got something like 50 from the police department. They asked Richard Murphy if he had any complaints against him. Well, he hadn't had complaints against him. He said no. But they didn't ask Boss that because there is a major case that Boss was involved with in 1997, the Bailey case. We've had his father on Democracy Now!, this 22-year-old man who was confronted by police, including Kenneth Boss, in 97. They ultimately shot him in the buttocks, and they then handcuffed him, and as he lay bleeding to death, he was just 3 minutes from the hospital. He didn't get there for something like 40 minutes, and he died. Now, they didn't ask him if he had complaints against him, but they did ask about his medals. So doesn't that open the door for the prosecution to start talking about his past record?
Well, apparently it didn't, and I wasn't privy to the pretrial rulings. But there is, in New York, the law is that the judge will make a determination prior to the trial as to whether what is referred to as bad, vicious, or immoral conduct can be brought into a trial. And the distinction there's a distinction between that and prior crimes. Obviously, these officers do not have criminal records, so what the prosecution would have been limited to bringing in would be these bad, vicious, or immoral acts. I think with regard to some of the civilian complaints that were filed against these officers, since they weren't substantiated, and of course, you know, we can get into the reasons why I think they weren't substantiated or may not have been substantiated. Since there was nothing substantiated in terms of their having actually acted inappropriately, that may have served as a basis for the judge saying that those acts couldn't come in.
Very quickly, when you say that they were unsubstantiated, what is your problem with that?
My problem with that is that I don't think CCRB's Civilian Complaint Review Board is any kind of effective body. I think that they never, or not, I shouldn't say never, I think most of the time they don't substantiate complaints against officers. I think it's incredibly difficult. And I have to tell you, I have clients who come in to me who want to file CCRB complaints. Not only don't these complaints get substantiated, but they have trouble even getting a desk officer to give them the form to fill out the complaint.
We're going to talk about that in just a minute with a person who went undercover in New York and went into precincts and asked for those forms. What about the prosecution declining to cross-examine Fife, the last expert witness? This is Jim Fife from Temple University, who was formerly in the New York Police Department.
Okay, this is where reasonable minds are going to differ. I have colleagues who are defense attorneys who have said to me, you know, when you have an expert who's done a great job on the stand, sometimes you just don't want to touch that person because you don't want to open the door to all kinds of stuff that can send you down the tubes. My take on it, that prosecution was down the tubes at that point. I think that when you leave a jury an impression where you've had a police expert on the stand who's done nothing but talk about how what these cops did was justifiable, and you do nothing to touch that expert, you're sending a crystal clear message to the jury that you have nothing to say. I think I would call it a mistake, except I don't think it was a mistake. I think it was done again because I don't think they wanted those top charges to stick.
They could have brought back then, not end with Fife, not end with the flavor of Fife in this trial, then closing arguments are Tuesday. They could have brought in a rebuttal witness. Why didn't they?
Absolutely. I think for the same reason I just stated. And again, I just want to going back to Fife for a minute. I think there's a way, even if they thought they'd be getting into dangerous territory with him, I think there would have been a way to minimally cross-examine him so that you could at least elicit some minimal information about the street crimes unit
I want to talk about that in 1 second, but stations have to identify themselves. Also, Frank Serpico, everyone remembers Serpico from the movie. Al Pacino played him, the police officer in the 1970s, who stood up against an NYPD, New York police corruption, will be joining us tomorrow, and he has a few words to say about the last expert witness. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we wrap up with Leslie Brody, the co-chair of the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, and the analysis of the case that we have just heard presented over the last few weeks in Albany, New York, the state capital of the four New York City police officers, all white, who are involved in the killing of who killed Amadou Diallo. It is a murder trial. They're charged with second-degree murder, talking about Albany, how it ended up there, and what effect you think this has had in the actual trial.
Well, I think ultimately it's going to be hard to tell what effect the Albany jury had on this because of the job that the prosecution did was so ineffective. But what I want to talk about is how personally offended I feel that this case was taken out of the Bronx. I think that Bronx jurors would have absolutely brought their life experience with police into their deliberations. I think that's what attorneys ask jurors to do. They ask them to use their common sense and common experience. And they've had bad experiences with the police. So they would have been justifiable in drawing from those experiences. But jurors have integrity, and Bronx jurors have integrity. And ultimately, they would have decided the case fairly. I have no doubt about that. And I think it was incredibly offensive that they moved the case to Albany.
How'd
but not surprising.
How'd they swing it for listeners around the country?
They did it based on, quote unquote, adverse publicity. And I have to tell you that when the defendants are not police officers, you don't get changes of venue in New York based on adverse publicity.
The issue of race, we heard it mentioned almost not at all through this trial, and this also goes to the issue of the street crimes unit. We've almost not heard the tactics specifically of the street crimes unit as opposed to the police raised here.
Absolutely, and I can't say with certainty that there wasn't some ruling involved involving that by the judge, but if there was, certainly that's questionable. These officers are in the street crimes unit, the unit that, according to them, quote-unquote, quote, owns the night. And the fact that race was not an issue. This is the unit, by the way, I just want to say the Center for Constitutional Rights brought a lawsuit to shut this unit down because of their persistent stops of young black men that were unjustified.
In fact, we are joined on the phone by Nancy Chang. Nancy Chang is with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and they're the ones who brought that trial, and we're going to go to her in who brought that case against the street crimes unit, and we're going to go to her in just 1 minute. But final comments as we see this trial wrap up and the consideration of, and the prosecution brought this up yesterday as they were responding to the motions to overall dismiss, and that was lesser charges.
Right. As far as lesser charges go, certainly the prosecution was going to ask for lesser charges because, again, there's got to be an appearance that they're bringing some level of prosecution here, and there was no basis. I believe the way they presented the case, there is not going to be a murder two conviction. So it was totally in the prosecution's advantage to ask for lesser included charges and give the jury an opportunity to compromise if they want to convict the officers of anything.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Leslie Brody, head of the co-chair of the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we're going to move right to Nancy Chang on the telephone with us, who is senior litigation attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's brought this lawsuit to close down the street crimes unit. Why, Nancy Chang?
Hi, Amy. Well, we brought this suit about a month after the Amadou Diallo shooting, and our objectives here are to get a court order ending the illegal practices of the unit, in particular the widespread stop and frisks that don't meet the requirement of the Fourth Amendment, which is that the police have individualized reasonable suspicion of illegal conduct. And we, the police department had released statistics shortly after Amadou Diallo's death showing that in the recent period of time of about 2 years, tens of thousands of people had been stopped by this unit without an arrest. So the case is somewhat unusual, and there are very few of these cases against police departments seeking injunctive relief, largely because the Supreme Court in 1983 really put an obstacle in everyone's way, and it's in a case called City of Los Angeles v. Lyons. And basically in that case, the Supreme Court turned a blind eye to the reality of racism in policing and said that a black man who had been placed in a chokehold by the Los Angeles Police Department and rendered unconscious did not have what's called standing to seek injunctive relief because it wasn't likely that this would happen to him again. And, in fact, in that case, there were statistics presented that 12 out of 16 people who had died from the chokeholds were black. So we filed this suit despite this obstacle, and fortunately we survived a motion to dismiss in October, and we have been given the green light to go ahead with our claims for injunctive relief.
Give us some statistics on who gets stopped by the street crimes unit.
Let me tell you that the
breakdown by race.
Right. The statistics come from the police department itself, and the officers are all required to fill out what are called stop and frisk forms. And as you probably heard during the testimony, the four officers on trial for Amadou Diallo's death admitted that they had not completed these stop and frisk forms for stops that they had made earlier that night. So already we're dealing with a flawed database. But these forms ask the officer to not only state the reason for the stop, but to also state the race of the individual stopped, their age, and other information. And the Attorney General of the State of New York did an incredibly sophisticated statistical analysis of 175,000 of these reports and came up with some quite alarming statistics, not only about the police department, but particularly about the street crimes unit, and they show definite skewing by race. The street crimes unit makes up only 1% of the police force here in New York, yet they were responsible for over 10% of the reported stops and frisks. And I should just interject here, we have to be probably more worried about the stops and frisks that took place and that were not reported. The Attorney General has estimated that perhaps as many as only 1 out of 10 is actually reported. And because these reports hold the police officer accountable for their actions, I think it's only safe to assume that the reports that are not completed are the ones that may be more likely to be found without reasonable suspicion and to be illegal.
So let's look at racial breakdown of whites who are stopped. How many are arrested?
With the street crimes unit, the ratio for whites who are stopped to people arrested is about 9.6, and for blacks it's about 16.
To one.
And
so
then,
you have nine whites stopped for each arrest. So eight people who are just let to go on their way. But in the case of African Americans, you've got almost double the amount of stops for each one arrested.
Right. And for Latinos, it's about 14 to one. And also, if you look at the population of the city of New York, blacks make up 25% of the population here. And when you look at the police department as a whole, half the people that are stopped are black, but when you get to the street crimes unit, you end up with 62%. So we have very troubling statistics, and I think the larger lesson that has to be drawn from this the tragedy of Amadou Diallo's death is that these aggressive, confrontational, commando-like police tactics are going to lead to tragedies, and that we have a unit that is not based in any particular precinct and that is discouraged from developing ties with the communities in which they police. And as a result, it's all too easy for them to come to view the people they are supposed to serve as enemies and to believe that they have free license to stop and frisk them at will.
Well, I'm sorry none of these figures were brought out at the trial, but Nancy Chang, I want to thank you for joining us, senior litigation attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. If people want to get in touch with CCR, where can they call, or is there a website?
The Police Watch is really interested in hearing about any encounters with police that people have, and that number is 614-6454.
That number, again, is 212-614-6454. Nancy Chang, thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we talk now with an African-American retired officer, retired detective from the New York Police Department, Graham Weatherspoon, who is with us doing some analysis of the trial as we were going live to Albany again. That is not taking place today. Closing arguments will be on Tuesday. But what we didn't get to talk to him about is his own experiences within the New York Police Department. He is a leader of the group 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care, fighting police brutality and abuse. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning, Amy.
Well, it's good to be with you. I still have stuck in my mind from earlier this week a story you told about your time as a transit officer, New York City transit officer, and you're being stopped by white police officers in New York City. Can you describe that experience as you were going after someone and trying to help your partner?
Yes, it wasn't exactly a stop. It was an assault. I was running down 6th Avenue from 40th Street to 35th Street. A robbery had taken place in an underpass. There was an underpass that connects 40th Street to 35th Street underneath 6th Avenue, connecting the two stations, 42nd Street and 34th Street. We were watching two guys who we believe were going to execute a robbery, and they did. I ran down 6th Avenue to 35th Street because that's the direction that they were heading. My partner was in pursuit of them in the underpass. The next staircase which they could exit was at 35th Street. I ran down 35th Street, entered the subway near Macy's department store. There was a uniform officer standing near the booth there. He had heard my partner's radio transmission, and he was waiting to see the guys run up that ramp. They did not arrive, nor did my partner. So I said to him, I said, well, I'm going to go down and see where Robbie is because I figured maybe they doubled back on my partner. As I turned from the officer, a guy grabbed my left arm.
You're in plain clothes?
I'm in plain clothes, yes. A short guy grabs my my left arm and says, where the F are you going? That was his opening statement. I looked at the uniform officer. I looked back at him. I said, listen, where I'm going and what I'm doing is none of your business. Number two, get your hand off of me. He says, I'm a cop. You're not going anywhere. I said, well, I don't see any ID, and you're not holding me. So I showed him how to let go of me. I said, when you get up, you better go about your business. And I turned to go down the ramp. He got up again and ran around me and stood in front of me and punched me in my chest. So at that point...
Didn't the uniform officer say to him, he's a cop too?
What was so astounding is that the uniform officer said absolutely nothing.
You're desperate to get to your partner
because
you're afraid that they...
Precisely. And
the robbers have gotten
precisely,
them.
Right. So with me, my attitude is if there's going to be a physical confrontation, it's going to be less than one round. So I had to eliminate him from the scenario quickly. I threw a kick into his throat. As I threw the kick... I was struck from my left side by his partner now, who, as he's running up, he sees me kicking his partner.
Are they both white officers?
One turned out to be Hispanic. Acted as though he were white, and he was the initial officer. When the second officer strikes me from the left side, I pivot to my right and grab him, and I take him over my shoulder and throw him into the ground. I'm now on the ground with the two of them. Unbeknownst to me, two guys from my unit were nearby, and they saw the guy approach me, and they thought it was a joke, because they were laughing. They said, look at this guy, it's a joke. He's about 5'7", 5'8". Then they realized it was a real fight, and they ran over, and we all got up, and the initial officer says to me, you effing transit cops, stay off the street, stay off the effing street. And I said, listen, I was doing this job when you were probably holding on to your mother's skirt. I want to see some ID. I don't have to show you any ID. I said, oh, yes, you do. I said, I better see it now. So he steps back. He says, I'll blow your effing brains out. And there were a lot of people around. I told the people to move back out of the way. I said, if you're prepared to die, draw. I said, because you don't know who you're dealing with. I said, we will kill you down here. One of the fellas who backed me up was Billy Massey. Billy was a black belt. He was standing next to the initial officer. His partner was standing near me. Another officer, Joe Schweiger, who was also in the transit task force, he was standing a few feet from me. We said, go ahead. Let's do this now. So they eased their hands away from their guns. I said, no, don't back out of it. Let's do this. We're grown men here. So they backed out of the scenario. I went to find my partner. There was a man who had been struck in the head. We got an ambulance for him. I summoned my inspector who came in from Brooklyn, and we went over to the Midtown South precinct. I told him I just want the names of the officers and their tax registry numbers. When we got over there, Jack Maple also was with us. He was a sergeant at that time in the task force. We got over to Midtown South precinct, and when I came through the door, everybody in the front desk area stopped, because this officer had gone back boasting about how he had whipped some transit cop's ass. When I walked through the door, I looked around. Everybody was like, So they went into the captain's office. Jack Maple comes out and says to me, he says, well, Spoon, you know, they just want to smooth things over. I said, I didn't come here to smooth over anything. I don't allow people to violate me. These guys are lucky I didn't shoot them. I want the names and tax registry. We went into a meeting in the captain's office. The first officer said, I struck you because I was afraid. Again. And this was in 1985. We have the same scenario here. He was afraid. I said, well, if you were afraid, you should have waited for your partner. If you were afraid, you should have stayed home. If you were afraid, you shouldn't be doing this job.
You're a cop, and even before this whole scenario played out, he understood you were a cop, and he was going to still take you on. So imagine you're a person just on the street.
Well, I hadn't identified myself to him because I wasn't taking a police action with regard to anything. All right, I was standing there talking to a uniform officer when he came up. He never even spoke to the uniform officer. He came right to me, and I'll make this quick. I filed a complaint. They said, well, you know, we're all brothers. I said, I'm not into that brother stuff. All right? You don't violate me. And I had worked with detectives in Midtown South back in 1978, long before that officer had joined the police department. I filed a complaint. The chief of operations was to get back to me and let me know what was going to be done with the officers. I didn't hear anything. See, but there's always the checks and balance systems, and you don't trust one person to do something for you. When I left Midtown South, I went to 26 Federal Plaza. I sat with the FBI and filed a petition there that night. I told them, wait 30 days. 30 days later, they went to one police plaza to pull the jacket on my complaint. There was absolutely nothing in the folder.
You mean there was no investigation?
No investigation, none. And you need to be mindful of the fact that if you are violated in any way, in a very egregious manner, you have 90 days to serve notice of claim against the city of New York. The police department will wait you out, and after 90 days, if you haven't filed any paperwork, they'll totally disregard you.
Because they won't do the investigation.
After 90 days, you cannot sue the city. So the FBI went in. It was a big uproar, and there was a reporter from El Diario who had recorded the incident. He was standing there in the crowd and recorded the incident, and as it turned out, the FBI wound up getting that tape and was able to hear the entire scenario as it unfolded. All right. Needless to say, those officers, one who was working part-time at the Wiz, he can't get anything in the police department. Matter of fact, he was working out of the trunk of his car.
Were they kicked out?
No, but they were severely punished and denied promotion.
We're talking to Graham Weatherspoon, who's retired detective in the New York Police Department, also was a transit cop, now with 100 Blacks and Law Enforcement Who Care. When we come back from our break, we will also be joined by Jop Kamau, who's executive director of the Police Complaints Center, a national nonprofit that provides assistance to victims of police misconduct. He was a deputy with the Ventura County Sheriff's Department, as well as a field supervisor, detective, and sergeant with the Hawthorne, California Police Department, and went undercover in New York and filmed people trying to file complaints in police stations. He also had an experience, he himself, in law enforcement with white officers in California, and we'll hear about that in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back soon. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined by Graham Weatherspoon, who is a former New York police detective, now with 100 Blacks and Law Enforcement Who Care. And we've also got on the phone with us Jop Kamau. Jop Kamau, who went undercover in New York to see how easily people could file complaints against police, also had his own experiences as deputy with the Ventura County Sheriff's Department, as well as field supervisor, detective, and sergeant with the Hawthorne, California Police Department. We just listened to Graham Weatherspoon describe his experience with cops, even though he was a cop. What about your experience, Kamau Jop?
I'd like to say that, first of all, this program is probably one of the more thorough analyses of this problem that I've heard, and I think it's important that people get a cross-section of information. The attorneys have one point of view, but as minority officers, we have an additional point of view that's important to be heard. My father was an officer for 30 years and with the L.A. County Sheriff's, and I joined, and I was a cop for 10 years. And what I have found in looking at this issue is that the level of racism, it would be startling to most folks in the public who've never put on a police uniform. You find things that you would think going on in the Deep South going on right now today in America's largest police departments. And both in my experience, and I'll just recount a few of the more notable incidents I've had. For example, my first training officer, the very first night we rode together, I got in the police car with him, and he asked me if I know that there's seven types of niggers. Now, this is a man I've never met before in my life. He goes on to tell me that there's swamp niggers, sand niggers, ghetto niggers, coon niggers, porch niggers, regular niggers, and black people who are also niggers, and tells me how we're supposed to treat each one of these particular groups. Now, I was literally sitting in the car in shock. That was the first night I rode. That night, I decided that if I spoke out against it at that moment, my career would be short-lived. So I pretty much kept my mouth closed. And consulted with my family and friends and went on about my work. I rose through the ranks pretty rapidly. I continued to run into acts of racism. I had a lieutenant that said, we actually had an African-American female who had been raped, and the lieutenant said that black women enjoy being raped and considered gang rape a party. At that point, I filed a complaint, and that's when things started to unravel. And while I was in the midst of an administrative action against the officers who had made these comments, my father was traveling home. He was off duty. Police officer had a heart attack. Was stopped and beaten by several officers from Pomona, California Police Department. At that juncture, I decided that I'm going to take on this problem and start to address it differently. And that meant that I would use my talents and investigative skills to actually start to document police abuse. Most folks probably know about me from the incident in Long Beach, California, where we did a hidden camera examination of police brutality using NBC News undercover cameras to drive through an area in Los Angeles, and we were pulled over by a Long Beach police unit. I was ultimately thrown headfirst through a window. And the interesting thing I think that it's important for the public to hear on that encounter.
What do you mean you were thrown through a window?
Well, the officer stopped me, ordered me to stand still, told me to turn around and face the window. When I turned to the window, he grabbed me from the back, slammed my face through the glass, pulled me out of the window, bashed my head into the hood of the car, took me to the rear of the car, bashed my head into the trunk, kicked me, and then handcuffed me and threw me in the car. And at that point, he turned around, and there were two news cameras standing behind him. So the point I was going to make is that the beating is not as important as what they did to cover it up, which is what people are hearing in this Diallo trial. They're hearing staged, scripted testimony that has been practiced over and over and over to get cops out of situations when they get in trouble. So it's a choreographed dance. So when you can hear officers on the stand saying, he reached for a weapon, I saw a glint. Some of the stuff is just so preposterous it's not even worth commenting on. But as in my case, they claimed that I attacked them. That was what was in their official police report. They said that I jumped out of the car in a karate stance with my fist clenched. I was bouncing all over the sidewalk, and then I tried to grab the officer's baton.
Let's remember they said that Amadou Diallo was in a combat stance.
Exactly. Well, there's three terms. They'll say karate stance, combat stance, or fighting stance. It's a script. And so most people in the public who sit on the jury don't have any idea. So they hear these things, and they think these are fresh, new revelations from the officer's account of the incident. Every cop in the station knows that you put those terms in the report to saturate it, to protect yourself from possible liability. So, again, in my case, they said I was in a fighting stance and that I was about to attack the officers, and they were the victims. They were defending themselves, which is almost always the case. And my question to the public and to the police department is, if that's the case and if that's how these events take place, why don't you ever hear about white males on Wall Street or anywhere else in New York or any other major city who were shot under similar circumstances? You don't hear about white males reaching for their wallet and being shot in the head. You just don't hear it. African-American males are subject to the threat of abuse and violence without any action on their own part. And to get to the other point you made about our investigation of NYPD, we found that NYPD is probably one of the worst departments in the country with regard to how they investigate complaints against officers. Most departments, you might say, have a bad record because they let officers get away with it. They don't prosecute officers. They don't find them guilty. NYPD doesn't even let you file the complaint. What we documented over the course of the last 3 years is that in more than 50% of the entries that citizens walk into a police station attempting to file a complaint, they will get misinformation. They will not be given the information consistent with the policy, or they may be under threat of being abused while they're in the station. We sent in testers throughout precincts all over New York City. We were thrown out routinely. We were told that they didn't have complaint forms. In fact, most people don't know that Abner Louima's family tried to file a complaint, and they were thrown out. Similarly, in Los Angeles, with the Rodney King case, Rodney King's family went in the next day, and they were thrown out and told that we don't have complaint forms. You can't file a complaint here. That's the reality.
I have seen that.
Jop Kamau, executive director of the Police Complaint Center. Graham Weatherspoon,
yes,
retired
when I was a detective in District 4, matter of fact, it was shortly after I was promoted to the rank of detective. I was in District 4 one day, and a black man
District
came in.
District 4 is where?
Union Square, 14th Street Union Square. A black man came in to report that he had been beaten by a transit police officer at Union Square Station about 3 weeks prior. He had beat the fare. The officer stopped him to give him a summons, took him into a room on the station, put a gun in his mouth, and played Russian roulette with him. He didn't know at that time that the weapon was unloaded, but needless to say, he thought he was about to die. He passed his urine on himself, and then the officer beat him in the room, told him don't ever beat the fare again or he'll get beat again. He went to a physician. The physician told him that he would never extend his arm to enable, which would enable him to straighten his elbow out. He came to District 4 to file a complaint. The desk officer said to him, you have to see Lieutenant Grupa. There's no such person, and there was at that time no such person in the New York City Transit Police Department. And I heard the sergeant, as I came from my office, I heard the sergeant tell me, you have to come back later and see Lieutenant Grupa. And I looked, and the gentleman said, do you work here? I said, yes, what's the problem? And he told me what had transpired. And I told him, I asked him, do you have a pen? He says, yeah. I said, go write his name down. Go back to the desk and get his name. I said, there is no Lieutenant Grupa here. And the sergeant looked at me. I said, let me tell you something. Don't play games when I'm working. I said, get his name and his shield number. The man went over, looked at his name. He came back. I said, you got it? He says, yes. I gave him my name and shield number, and I told him exactly what to do. I said, you go downtown to Internal Affairs Bureau. You file a complaint with Internal Affairs. Go over to Hogan Place, to the District Attorney's Investigation Bureau. File a complaint with them. Walk across the street to 26 Federal Plaza and file a complaint with them. I said, and don't tell Macy's that you've been to Gimbel's. All right? I said, and you retain an attorney for yourself. That officer, and he said he could identify the officer, indubitably. And that officer wound up doing some state time, not because of what he did to this officer, but because this has happened 14 times prior.
What he did to the guy.
14 times prior, complaints had been filed against this officer. He was a PBA delegate.
Patrolman's Benevolent Association.
Right, he was a delegate.
Police union here.
Pete Marsala was his name. He was a PBA delegate, but they only fired him from the job when he did it to a male white whom he thought was Hispanic. And he was calling him by the S word, and the guy said, no, 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 I'm a Guzin just like you. But it wasn't until he victimized a white person that they took his job.
Job Kamau, you've not only looked at the New York Police Department, how tough it is to file complaints, but also in rural areas like small towns in Texas.
Yes, we've actually gone all over the country and probably done more than 300 tests using hidden cameras. We send in African-American males, Latinos, and whites to see how police react to citizens who try to file complaints. And overwhelmingly, black and Latino testers are given bad information or physically threatened or even threatened with arrest in these encounters where they're simply asking, "How can you tell me how to file a complaint?" So oftentimes when I go on talk shows and I do debates with members of the police associations, they say complaints are down, there are no complaints, there's no evidence. Well, the fact is the people are being deterred and discouraged to want to report. And what you need to know is the connection here is that when officers know that complaints made against them will never succeed in reaching the ears of the police chief or top administration, they can assume that they can do whatever they want. And I think in most cases, the worst departments in the country, this is the practice. It's standard. It's routine. Complaints are not allowed. And so folks who have complaints about whatever, and I'd like to give some advice consistent with what Graham was just talking about, you should never walk into a police station and expect, or maybe you should expect it, but you won't get it, to simply file your complaint there and have that complaint work its way up the system. You need to file at other places with other folks who have oversight relative to the police department, and that would include the DA's office, the city manager. You need to go to an attorney if you can find one, and never assume that if you go in there and give a complaint verbally that it will go anywhere except in the trash can. The officers call it file 13. They will simply disregard your complaint or attempt to mediate your complaint at the counter so that it never gets on paper.
I said that we were going to talk about the LAPD scandal, Los Angeles Police Department scandal, that is unfolding as we speak. Absolutely incredible stuff around the anti-gang unit called the Crash Rampart Division. Now one of their own has flipped, providing 50 hours of testimony to investigators. That's unraveling one of the biggest corruption scandals in the history of the Los Angeles Police Department. In his hours of testimony, Rafael Perez, a former LAPD officer from Rampart turned informant, has described how a secret fraternity of anti-gang officers and supervisors broke the law more often than they enforced it, shot unarmed civilians, planted guns and drugs on people, covered up their tracks by, quote, cleaning up police shooting scenes and fabricating stories. Stories are coming out now in the Los Angeles Times about the plaques that had a heart and two bullets with the number two. If the numbers were red, the victim survived. If the numbers were black, the victim died. Tattoos, a skull and a dead man's hand on them, worn by the officers, radio codes, ramp hot officers had secret radio codes that they used to send out information on a police shooting. They would prevent all other police units to have access to the scene of the shooting as they, quote, cleaned it up. Jop Kumau, is this something you understood when you worked there, though not?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm from Los Angeles. I was born and raised there. And LAPD has been notorious for abusing people on a regular basis. And I think that many of your listeners probably don't know what CRASH means. The term, their acronym CRASH, is Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums. And when you have a department, an official government agency, walking around with that title, what do you think they're going to do? They identified themselves as being soldiers in a war. And their approach to dealing with gang members or so-called, and this is a whole other issue, how the media, to some extent, has validated the police operations by, I mean, cops and real stories of the higher patrol and going along with the cops and making this some sort of fun sort of, you know, mission that the police are on, some noble crusade, when really it's just about a lot of abuse and intimidation and misuse of authority. And you'll never see that on one of these shows as it really is going down. But in, from what I know, as an activist and someone who's investigated police abuse, this has been going on long before Chief Parks was chief. And I think it's really a mistake for people to direct their heat or their attention on Chief Parks and think that this is something that just came up under his administration. The seeds for the abuse that's going on were planted with Chief Parker, Daryl Gates, a variety of others. And it is based on multiple scandals within the LAPD that really have gone uncorrected. And what people also don't know is that police chiefs, the top administrators within the LAPD who basically have endorsed much of this abuse over the years, have been floated all over the country. Other police departments are hiring these guys to run their agencies. I mean, for example, Philadelphia, one of the most corrupt and abusive departments in the U.S., hires from New York. Other places in the U.S., cities that need a police chief, they go to LAPD because they think they're going to get something special. So what they end up with are multiplications or mimicking of the same practices in Los Angeles taking place in other cities. And to the specifics of the scandal, let's just talk about it. You've got 3,000 cases right now under review. You've got 70 officers directly under investigation.
In L.A.
In L.A. 23 cases have been overturned where people have been released because they were completely innocent. You've got an estimate right now that this is going to cost over $200 million to resolve these cases. The police chief himself has asked for $9 million just to deal with what's going on internally in the LAPD, and the city council just gave the inspector general, who works with the police commission, a blank check to investigate these things. Now, what bothers me as much as the abuses that have gone on is the reaction of the general public in Los Angeles. There really is not the kind of uproar. There was actually, I think, more outrage about the O.J. trial and the O.J. verdict as opposed to this massive level of abuse and human rights violation.
Jop Kumau, I'm going to have to cut you off here because we're coming to the end of the show, but we're going to continue this discussion. We're either going to do it tomorrow. We are hoping to have Frank Serpico on tomorrow, the cop who fought New York police corruption in the 1970s, a big movie made about him. And if we're not able to do it tomorrow, we're going to do it in the next 2 days of the beginning of next week. But I want you to be able to give out phone number, police complaint center, your organization.
Yes, 850-894-6819, or go to policeabuse.com on the web.
Policeabuse.com, and I want to thank you for being with us. And also, Graham Weatherspoon, retired detective with the New York Police Department.
Yes, I'm with 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care. Our hotline number is area code 718-455-9059. Our mailing address is 591 Vanderbilt Avenue. 591 Vanderbilt Avenue, Suite 133. That's Brooklyn, New York, 11238.
And we will have the numbers, addresses, websites on our website at www.pacifica.org or www.democracynow.org. That does it for the show. 1-800-735-0230 is the number to call to order a cassette. 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Tomorrow, hopefully, Frank Serpico. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!